When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome back to the Woven Energy Podcast on Real Practical Shamanism with me, Joseph Sayakora, and as always, Damon Smith. We are here once again to talk about shamanism from the ground up. So we left last week's episode, The Pitfalls of Learning Shamanism Part 2, on a little bit of a cliffhanger. I think towards the end of the episode, Damon realized that we have about a million other things that we can talk about that we didn't get onto. So this is going to be a direct continuation. Damon, how are you doing, man?
Very good, mate. How are you?
Good, good. You know, we talk about the dearth state a bit. I mean, a little bit of that, you know. So maybe this podcast can snap me out of it. I hope so, anyway.
maybe after the podcast, you go and do some chelicity practice and that'll snap you out of it.
You know, I think I will. I think I'll go out into the woods and stare at trees.
And that goes for everyone listening as well.
Yeah. Well, this is what
go
I find.
Go for it, guys.
I do find myself particularly susceptible to that kind of brain fog thing. And there's all the science that I've been looking into about the dopamine levels, hormone levels and imbalance and all that. But there is the other side to it, which is just getting out into fresh air, doing some chelicity practice, which is absolutely the other side of the coin. And, you know, yeah, we could all do a little bit more of that, couldn't we?
Indeed.
So, Damon, take it away, because towards the end of last episode, you basically just said, you know what, I can talk for another hour on this, so...
Yeah, so, I mean, what occurred to me was this one big thing that isn't, you know, isn't particularly... I mean, there's a ton of pitfalls in learning shamanism, and we'll talk about them. I mean, for instance, once you start getting into level 4, which we are, and the main sequence episodes... there's a ton of pitfalls around each individual energy change. You know what I mean? For instance, a really obvious one is keeping Tyrak out of there, you know, keeping Tyrak out of the change, unless it's part of the change. The thing that occurred to me at the end of the last...
And that's cutting. That's cutting the flow of the energy, yeah.
The thing that occurred to me at the end of the last one was there's something that, you know, we said there's a lot of stuff, a lot of permutations around the imagination trap, and we've talked about the imagination trap an awful lot. There is one that comes up quite quickly, relatively quickly in your shamanic practice that isn't actually to do with the imagination trap. It's a whole other type of trap. And you can see this in a lot of what you might call experienced shamans around the world. And that is what I would call the Gukuk trap. There's nothing wrong with Gukuk, but Toshaltin and Gukuk are parts of that kind of state that goes to make up chelicity. But Gukuk is entirely a positive thing, that you do want that. But there's a thing that I would call Gukuk-based laurel resting. And probably the easiest way to understand this is if you look at shamans who do spirit dance, but their spirit dance is quite simple, they are very, very good at, or through many years of practice, they become very, very good at a small range of changes that are probably beneficial to them and probably beneficial to those around them, kind of by proxy, in terms of the role the shaman's playing. But they're not as much or as broad as they could be. But the shaman's kind of fallen into that Gukuk-based laurel resting. Hey, I'm good at this. You know, it's not so much that he's thinking, or she is thinking, I don't really want to do other energy changes. It's just they've fallen into a sort of self-satisfied state. I'm happy with where my spirit dance is at. I'm happy with where my drum technique is at. I'm happy with where my homilk is at. And they fall into the trap of not growing as a shaman, of coming to a static state, if you like.
Well, it's interesting because when you look around the different cultures, you see spiritual practices like the whirling dervishes and the zikir. And you see these sort of very repetitive kind of movements that clearly have their basis in shamanism, which is perhaps not so anymore, but and they're more ritualistic now. But some of them definitely do put themselves into a trance doing this stuff. But it's interesting you're saying that, because if somebody's resting on their laurels when it comes to guhuk, perhaps they've reached that point, realized that they're getting a certain result from this small repetitive kind of movement, like, for instance, spinning round and round like the whirling dervishes.
Yeah.
And they feel like that's it, they're done.
It's a great example because you can see, when you see a bunch of them, they often do it together in the group, don't they? And you can see, usually among the group, you can see a couple of people who have really got into a state of chelicity and who are really, really good at it because they've practiced it so much, but actually they're not doing very much. You know, they're just, there's not a lot of variety there. And this energy radar that I've talked about, which isn't just a radar for nature via spirit dance, ditto drum technique has an energy radar, and a ditto homilok has an energy radar. I don't know if radar is the best word, but there's a weave produced through the technique. And that weave ideally is interacting with the weave of the environment and gaining, the shaman is gaining knowledge through the interaction between these kind of two weaves that become one weave ultimately. Mm. The richness of that weave ideally mirrors the richness of the weave in the environment. The issue that the vast majority of shamans, myself included, have is that the weave within the environment, when you really start to understand it, is insanely complex. Almost off-puttingly complex. If you're going to try and match that, you know, match the weave of nature with your own human spirit dance weave, for instance, that's a high, high bar for anybody, a very high bar. Every change that occurs within nature, even within a localized area, you know, for instance, you're in the woods or something like that, or you're down by the beach, even the changes that occur in those localized areas, they are vast and complex and deep. And if you're interacting with them with a very, very simple weave, I don't mean like that staccato thing that, you know, bad people doing bad spirit dance do with too much Tyrak and they're getting like a strobe effect. I mean somebody who really is good at spirit dance, but the richness of their spirit dance isn't matching the richness of the weave within nature, isn't there with it, isn't fully able to participate in it because there just aren't enough changes in it to participate in all of those changes within the natural weave. That is a shaman who's sort of given up, you know, maybe not consciously. They haven't got to stop, well, why I'm stopping now, but maybe they just become a bit too self-satisfied. Do you follow what I mean?
Well, we've got the components of chelicity. We've got Bat, Toshaltin, and Guhuk, right? And Guhuk is the component of almost like a deep spiritual understanding of the skill in which you are trying to develop, right? You develop that kind of grace within the skill set that you're doing. I might have butchered that, but in general, that's right.
Yeah.
That's the idea. So perhaps when a shaman reaches that stage and sort of resting on the guhuk laurels, they have forgotten about that component of Toshaltin.
Exactly, which is where I was going. You have preempted me, mate.
Okay. Oh, I'm quite pleased with that one then.
Yeah. That's exactly it. You might think that when it comes to resting on your guhuk laurels, you say, I need to work more on my guhuk. Well, no, that's the problem. Your guhuk, within a very narrow scope, has become has become, and I wouldn't say too good, it's become very adequate within a narrow scope. The problem is not the adequacy of your guckuck. The problem is the adequacy of your Toshal teen. And so, you know, we said a little while ago, what's one of the applications that I used for the book of changes? It was exactly that. It was, which of these changes am I not doing? And I could rest on my laurels and I could look at other shamans and say, look, my spirit dance is real richer and more varied than that guy's spirit dance. That's me then saying, okay, now I'm doing my guckuck laurel resting, right? That's my, I'm comfortable with what I do. I've got further than a lot of people with it in my life. Therefore, that's okay. No, it's not okay. Yeah, because that's me giving up on Toshal teen. And in a way, that's me giving up on Chalicity, right? Because Toshal teen is just as an important component of Chalicity as guckuck is. So, and another place that you see this a lot is martial arts. And in the martial arts, again, as I've said, tiny subset of the vast subject of shamanism, you see quite a lot of people laurel resting on the martial arts that they know. You know, you know, I see people saying they do mixed martial arts and they're only doing three martial arts, you know, a bit of jiu-jitsu, bit of Muay Thai, maybe a bit of wrestling, something like that, you know. The bit of judo, you know, the thing is that gets to laurel resting as well, or even people who do only one martial art, which is even worse because those are the guys who tend to get very, very deluded about their ability. In the martial arts, that's almost dangerous, you know, because you inevitably think that it just so happens that the one martial art that you personally came across, the one that there happened to be a dojo at the bottom of your street, probably just so happens to be the best martial art in the world. And you were so lucky that it was there. And it must be because there's some sort of special thing about you as a special person that this martial art, just the best martial art in the world, came to you. I think that if you're a martial artist and you're not practicing an absolute bare minimum of three martial arts, when I say a bare minimum, there'll be three martial arts that are very different from each other, then frankly, that's not enough, in my opinion. 10 is a much better number to get serious about. If you can get there, you know, you'll see an awful lot of different angles and things to life in general. And one of the things that's very healthy about forcing yourself to do something new, and there's another reason for the laurel resting. You start to think it doesn't matter whether it's spirit dance or martial arts or drum technique or what, you start to think you're great. You know, you start to think that you are, you know, fantastic or very, very good at what you do because there's nothing to compare what you do to. You're not contrasting it against, you're probably practicing with a bunch of other people who only do one martial art if you only do one. Or you're probably comparing yourself to a bunch of other people who do your type of spirit dance if you do spirit, you know what I mean? You really need to compare yourself to people who do something completely different. And that is both humiliating in some ways, but it's also a joy. And it is the heart of Toshal teen. If you've been practicing, say, karate for 20 years or 10 years or whatever, and you're quite good at it, go and do some judo or something. Go and do some jiu-jitsu. If you think you're a brilliant martial artist, just see how long it takes you to maintain that thinking that you're a brilliant martial artist. You
know? And Toshal teen is important because it allows you to free up and be more experimental and playful, because one of the things that plagues the martial arts is, this is my style, this is my thing, I'm going to stick to this no matter what and everything. You know, you fall into that kind of...
Yeah.
Cultish mentality in martial arts is particularly susceptible to that, but there are a lot of other things in life that is, I guess. But
yeah, and also
it becomes your identity in a way, doesn't it?
Yeah,
and then you become less able to free from that. Yeah,
yeah, it has become part of the culture of martial arts. You see people who aren't very experienced in martial arts sort of doing a martial arts shopping kind of attitude. What's the best martial art for me to learn? It's that kind of thing when they're shopping around for a martial art answer. All of them. Every single one of them, if you possibly can, that's the best one for you to learn. Because then you're covering the most bases, you know? You find no matter which martial art you pick, you'll find people that there's something somewhere that you can learn. And the idea that there isn't is nonsense, you know, because people devote their lives to these things. But some have more that you can learn from than others. Obviously, in the martial arts field, the issue of testing or lack thereof has a big impact on how much or how little you can learn from that martial art. If the martial art has a lot of delusion built into it, it doesn't mean that you, in terms of it never tests itself, or practitioners of it never or rarely test themselves against, for instance, resisting opponents, then there's probably a lot of delusion in it. But that still doesn't mean that there isn't something somewhere in it that's of use. I mean, there's a couple of things that I still use out of Aikido, you know, for instance. Just a couple of things, not very much, it has to be said. But I do, you know, and I do feel like all those years I spent doing Aikido was a complete waste of time on the whole, but then there's still a couple of things that hang over from it that I do use. So in complete waste of time, it was just a 90% waste of time. You know? So anyway, I mean, coming back onto the, you know, using that as an analogy, just because I know a lot of our listeners have a martial arts background, take that over to spirit dance. It's the same thing. You know, what's the best spirit dance for me to learn? Or shall I learn Malaysian spirit dance? Or shall I learn Bolivian spirit dance? Or Colombian? Or, you know, Mongolian or whatever? No wrong attitude. That's not a Tarshal Teen attitude, right? Take all of those things, Ainu crane dancing or whatever, take them. And also, don't take them on as like the rigid systems or they're set in stone. Take them on as an influence. Incorporate them, but also play with them. You have to be playful in your cellisti if you want to progress. Play is a thing that... And there's another trap that people fall into that's sort of related to this one. The Gukuk laurel resting trap is related to the, hey, we're old now, let's drop Tarshal Teen trap. You know, play, for want of a better word, is something that kids do in school, right? When you get older, you have to get all sensible, don't you? For instance, in the workplace, you have to get all sensible and we can't be playing around anymore. I've seen horrified reactions to of managerial people to teams who play a lot, you know, teams who have team games or teams who play as they perceive it, who play around with, for instance, writing software or whatever the team is actually doing.
Yeah.
Although you get these horrified management reactions to that attitude, actually, those teams tend to be the best teams. They tend to be the most creative teams. They tend to be the fastest teams, the ones that have playful attitudes, you know. So there's something deeply wrong with management culture, some management culture, certainly in the UK, but also around the world, that stifles a lot of playfulness. And organizations that have a lot of playfulness and experimentation built into their attitudes tend to do incredibly well in business terms. So how we've ended up that there's this sort of management culture that's down on that kind of thing, when those organizations that do it, live and breathe that, do so well, is a weird thing. It's a very weird thing, you know?
Perhaps another analogy, another good analogy would be business in general. You know, you see these businesses grow and they flourish because they've found their particular niche and they've really dominated that niche. And then they kind of get that taste of success and they're pretty successful. And then the level of growth sort of tailors and it peters out and it kind of levels off. Because
and they don't see the end coming, do they? They don't see the end coming. That's the thing, you know,
no.
Because they're so established and they're so good at what they do, you know, long established.
And then the newcomers,
names.
The young buck newcomers come along and basically kick their ass and they end up on the decline because they kind of like, they reach that stage where everything's, they're just sort of keeping the system moving. Rather than innovating with the whole injection of Tarshal Teen, right?
Yeah, I mean, there was nobody better place than Blockbuster to do the Netflix thing. They even were offered, I believe, they were offered the chance to buy Netflix. They turned it down because because that's that online streaming thing is not what we do. We're really good at this, you know, high street video rental thing that we do. Maybe it was DVDs by that time. And we're dominant, and we don't think there's much in this online streaming thing. So we'll not bother buying this company for a tiny sum of money for them by the time. They don't see it coming because they've fallen into the Gooker trap. They've fallen onto Laurel resting.
Everything's working. Everything's comfortable. Everything's fine. Why disrupt that? It's working. Calm down. And that's exactly the role of these managers, exactly, isn't it? These managers come in, and their role isn't to innovate. Their role is to keep the status quo and just keep the wheel moving.
Yes. So the good news is that in terms of shamanism, becoming a shaman, you are your own manager. Yeah. So the only person you have to have a good talking to is yourself. Give yourself a bit of a slap around the face and get on with it. but don't stop learning new things. It's a really, really bad idea. Don't stop learning new things.
So when you say that about spirit dance, can you go a little bit deeper into that? Because what I'm worried about is, like, we've spent God knows how long on this podcast talking about the spirit dance and now into stage four. And then you're coming along now in the last 5 minutes and going, but you've got to be playful and do all sorts of other spirit dances. So just go into that a little bit.
So basically, you need to start to see spirit dance. I think we've said this many times. You know, I often cringe when I mean, sometimes I'm guilty of doing it. We use phrases like Mongolian spirit dance or Japanese spirit dance or the Shinshukyo flavors of spirit dance. That's a bad thing to say because there is only spirit dance. And spirit dance is all about energy. And within an energy changes and within the overarching hugely broad subject of spirit dance, there are verging on infinite energy changes that are potentially possible. And spirit dance that you might see a particular group of people practicing from a particular social background, maybe Mongolian spirit dance, for instance, you might see a bunch of recurring themes because they've sort of learned off nature. If they have learned off animals and they do an animal spirit dance, they've learned off the animals that are in their environment, that live in their region of the world. But what about all these other animals from all the way around the rest of the world? They've all got energy changes and they've all got things, and they're maybe not the same as the ones that are in that particular type of spirit dance. What I'm saying is you want to take on as broad a portfolio as possible. One little bunny step at a time, danto danto, as Mickey used to say. One little bunny step at a time. But you never want to stop those little bunny steps. And in spirit dance terms and in homiluk terms and in drum terms, it's all about incorporating more and more different types of energy changes in order to make your weave ever richer. In order to, and as long as you keep doing that, and also it becomes about, once you get to higher levels, 5 and 6 and stuff, it becomes against interacting with more and more different types of energy changes that are coming from outside yourself inwards, and the many and varied ways in which you can interact with those energy changes. You want to further increase the variety there as well, as much as you can. And the great thing, which is why you will never get bored with shamanism, as long as you approach it in the way of having a torsional team type of attitude, you will never become bored with this subject, as I have never even remotely come close to being bored with this subject, because it's absolutely vast. It's mind-bogglingly vast. I don't know, probably I shouldn't use the word mind. Spirit-bogglingly, I don't know if that's a word. Vast. To the greatest extent as possible. It's the biggest subject there is. I mean, over on Heretics, we've started doing this tutorial about, we just recorded another episode on calcination that's just about to come out. Started recording this tutorial on the very big and interesting subject of alchemy, teaching people how to do that. That is a huge subject. I mean, people have been working on it for hundreds of years, but compared to shamanism, it's a tiny little subject. It's all relative, you know. And so I guess, although this is one of the pitfalls of it, it's also one of the upside of it, right? You just will never become bored of shamanism as long as you look at the subject with a torsional teen kind of attitude.
Yeah, and perhaps you can view other what may have become ritualistic rather than core shamanic spirit dances through the lens of the spirit dance. So that it looks like it's now a ritual rather than anything else, but because it is rooted in shamanic practice, there's something there, and so being able to see that through that lens can be extremely beneficial, right?
Exactly. And that leads me on to another very closely related topic in terms of the changes that you're taking on. Some people have a natural liking to particular changes. Some people feel a natural affinity towards certain energy patterns. And as I've said before, just because you like something doesn't mean it's necessarily good for your shamanism. And one of the things that you see a lot once we get into an animal spirit dance is people having a particular liking for a particular animal spirit. I'm super guilty of this, which is fine. I mean, there's nothing you can enjoy, you know, tiger or bear or eagle or whatever it is that you enjoy. It's just fine. But you must not neglect the others. And you must not stop looking for others to incorporate. And maybe the one that you feel you're the worst at and the one that you enjoy the least, maybe that one is where you should be putting a lot of effort. And I certainly had that with my Xing Yi, for instance, the animals within Xing Yi. I never really liked goshawk very much. I find it very difficult. But I did work hard on it. And I got somewhere with it in the end. And so one of the things that you might be thinking about when you, I mean, we haven't really got on animal spirit dance on the main sequence episode yet, but we're very close. Animal spirit dance is also a level 4 type of thing. Once we get a lot of the changes down, then we'll start talking about the animals, which animals are basically a propensity towards a particular portfolio of changes. That's what animals are. They're exhibited by different animals in the wild. So you can, I mean, basically we have started on changes. You can probably understand that, you know.
We've started on change.
Yeah, a bag of interrelated energy changes that are typically exhibited by a particular animal in the wild. That's what animal spirit dance is. You incorporate that into your spirit dance, that portfolio of changes. Mm. My point is that you might like, I don't know, heron or merlin or ibis or something, whatever animal takes your fancy. You might like that. But there's another kind of laurel resting there. And again, it is the Gukuk-based laurel resting. I'm kind of good at tiger, you know, martial arts-wise and shamanism-wise, I'm kind of good at tiger and a few other animals as well that I've worked on. Therefore, probably tiger's not the one I should be working hard on, right? What I should be working hard on is what I'm not good at.
How would you
finding
balance?
Finding a completely new one and then going at that, yeah.
How would you balance breadth versus depth when it comes to something so complex and so...
Yeah, let's go with a square.
Like a lifelong ambition to get anywhere with spirit dance.
I think there's no right and wrong answer to that, but I think of a square, yeah? An ever-growing square. As the breadth increases, the depth increases, you know? That's a good way to think about it. I mean, the worst thing you can do is we already started slagging down the hippie movement, is, you know, very, very, very broad, incredibly shallow rectangle, right? You know, that's bad, yeah? But also incredibly narrow vertical column, you know? So maybe you do a type of spirit dance that focuses in on, like, two changes or something like that, you know, but you're really, really good at those two changes. That's an incredibly narrow column. Personally, I think the thing that's going to give you the broadest experience of nature as you mature as a shaman is to keep it square, you know, like they say in Freemasonry, you know, to keep it square so that your depth is forever rivaling your breadth. And as you go deeper, you go wider. And as you go deeper, you go wider. That's the... to me, that would be a good idea.
I have an analogy that I kind of teach with my piano students. And it's like, if you imagine you've got a big garden and you just water one plant in the corner. You'll just, you know, you'll end up with a very beautiful, massive, big tree in one corner of the garden, but the rest of it is just a barren wasteland. So it's like you want to be, you want to imagine your skill as a pianist increasing. Like you might water this plant over here for a little bit, and then you'll go over here, you'll water that one for a little bit, but the foundation of your skill will kind of increase, but it'll increase in a constantly imbalanced way.
Yeah.
But your foundation increases all the time. So,
well, I think, and in a positive note, Creative Piano Academy is a great example of keeping the Toshal team going, isn't it? I mean, most people, I think, naturally assume that when you go, certainly I had this when a kid, when I went to piano lessons, you start to learn set pieces, don't you? And they start you off with simple set pieces. And then you get a more complicated set piece and stuff, but you're always playing somebody else's music. I mean, I think the thing that was great about the Creative Piano Academy approach is, okay, I'm going to teach you to play your own, write your own music right from day one. I've never seen that before.
Yeah, my latest course, which is called Sit and Play Piano, is essentially just a course on piano shamanism. It really is. It's just, but it's like how you teach shamanism. You've got structures which you can learn the technique through, but all of those structures sort of fit together into developing you as a creative musician full of experimental, full of play, full of being able to create your own music that comes from within you. So, you know, and it's worked out. It's done pretty well as well. So, there's a market for it out there. I don't know.
But I think that the people crying out for that, and you could think you could apply this to all sorts of different things, couldn't you? I mean, for instance, something that just popped into my mind is, creative cooking. There are some celebrity chefs who are famous, that guy Heston and these sort of people, famous for that kind of creativity within the cooking. But I'm thinking, what about creative computer building? You know, a lot of people, when they teach somebody how to build their own PC, they're sort of teaching them from the point of view of this is sort of a plan, isn't there? We're going to use this and we're going to use this. So rather than sort of just, hey, let's start building a computer and see what it turns out like, you know, something like that, you know, just get playful as you're going along. Or think of if you're building a PC as like, it's a continuously evolving entity. It's not something that's ever finished. You're constantly upgrading it and changing it, changing its configuration, all this kind of stuff. That would be one thing you could teach like that. I mean, I think they try to get around that, don't they, in sports by having these ridiculous rules, because people will naturally tend towards that sort of thing unless you put some rules in that prevent them from doing so. You imagine some sort of Toshal team-based tennis players where every match they've got the net at a different height, or maybe they've got two nets. The triangle, super large rackets and super small rackets and all this kind of stuff. I did see a thing like that with a world professional dart player. He was playing a guy who was an okay sort of pub standard dart player. And the normal guy, the guy who was just like, you know, like a hobbyist who goes and plays in the pub every weekend or something like that, reasonably would beat most people at darts, you know. He was playing on a normal board, and this professional dart player was playing on this like microscopic little board that he had to hit, you know. And he still beat him. The professional still beat this guy, you know. You're seeing the difference between somebody who plays it all day long and somebody who doesn't, you know. But of course, in the real rules, they've got the standard board size, the standard distance from the board and stuff. Whereas, you know, thinking about my teacher, Sifu Ran, my martial arts teacher, he used to have a competition every year, and every year he would change the rules and not tell anybody what they were going to be until the day of the competition, you know. that's a really Toshal team way to do a martial arts competition, you know, so that nobody could train to the rules. That was the thing. You know.
Competitive sports from a shamanic perspective would be fascinating for me, because if you look at the foundation of what a competitive sport is, it's kind of like it's an expression of who we are as hunter-gatherer people. When you look at really what a sport does, either putting a ball into a net, it's like you've got an object, put it in a target. You get a spear, you put it in the animal. You know, it's like a lot of it is very
The javelin's really interesting, isn't it? Because it's just about how far you can throw it. And to me, javelin should have a target at very long range, you know, so busy. And maybe over 50 meters or something, then you have a target, you know. First of all, you have to be able to throw it over 50 meters, and then you have to get as close to the center of the target as possible. Then it's more like real hunting, right? You know. But
sport is an expression of shared play as well, isn't it? It's like, you do have rules. So the flip side of what you've just said, you do have those rules, but within those rules,
you can get creative within the rules. Yeah.
You definitely have that.
Said this many times about boxing. If you look at world champion boxers, boxing has a very, very tight set of rules. If you look at those top boxers, you know, the real greats, you know, Rocky Marciano and Mike Tyson, you know, these kind of guys. They all have very different styles from each other. Actually, within such a tight set of rules, they all have very different styles from each other.
Have you watched any of that Lomachenko?
I haven't, mate.
He's a lightweight, but he's, well, light medium weight, but he's so agile, and he almost dances around the ring, and he's, before the opponent knows it, he's round the other side of you.
Yeah. It reminds me of Prince Asim. Yeah. So that was not my point, though. My point was that they're very different from each other, but what they all have in common is none of them do what's in the Lonsdale boxing manual.
Mm.
They don't conform. They don't conform to what you'd be taught. If you went to a typical boxing club, what you would be taught is not what they do. That's the point. And the reason they're so good is that, to me, is that they've got creative within the admittedly incredibly constrained rules of boxing. They've got very, very creative.
Forces creativity, doesn't it? At the very high elite level of sport, it forces that creativity in order to compete.
Yeah. And
you have to. Rules. Otherwise you stagnate, just like we've been talking about.
Yeah, and in a way, you imagine something like a sport with no rules whatsoever. That is shamanism, right? There are no rules whatsoever. There are no constraints. There's only what you can make out of your energy patterns. I mean, there are historical precedents. There are ways that people have done, for instance, spirit dance and drum technique in the past. But who's to say that's how it has to be done in the future? And it's our responsibility, in a way, as the current generation of shamans to build and grow upon the great legacy that's been handed down to us, is to build and grow upon that and forever progress and expand and move outwards and do new stuff. That's kind of our responsibility, because that's Toshal Teen in the large, right? That's just not the Toshal Teen of one person. That's a Toshal Teen stack of multiple generations going back in time. And we do need to, I mean, this is what esotericism is all about. And there's the other thing, is the shamanism trap. Let's call this one the shamanism trap. Trying to do shamanism, pure hunter-gatherer style shamanism, in a settled, civilized society is verging on impossible. So if you try to, it's a recipe for misery, really. You know, it's a recipe for misery. At one time, it was a recipe for getting tied to a post and have logs stacked up underneath you, you know. the great question of esotericism is, what do we do about that problem? Yeah. You know, and to be fair to the esoteric movements, which have their own pitfalls and troubles, and you know, if you want to know about one of them, we're doing a tutorial on one of them over on Heretics at the moment, alchemy. The esoteric movements, they have their own pitfalls and their own problems and their own downsides. But the great upside is they're not resting on their laurels. They've said, look, we're going to address this issue. What does shamanism now mean, given that we don't live in the societies that shamanism grew up in, that shamanism evolved in? We don't live in those kind of societies anymore. So what does it mean for us? And so there's another trap. Oh, I'm only interested in shamanism. I'm not interested in esotericism. Well, if you are, then I hope you live out in the forest, you know, because if you don't live out in the forest, then you're away from other people and away from civilization, then you're probably not going to be very happy with some aspect of your life. Esotericism is a wonderfully interesting subject. It's a difficult subject in some ways. It's every bit as challenging as shamanism itself, because it's like, how do we use something that was developed for one purpose for completely different purposes? And what are those purposes? And what should we make them? Given this bizarre thing called society that we've created, what's the implication there? So there's another form of laurel resting.
And what would your answer be to that?
And my answer would be that...
What's the purpose of shamanism in a civil settlement society?
If you feel like you're a shamanism-only interested person, you know, as a Toshaltine exercise, why not remake yourself as a esotericism-interested person as well? You know, and go and listen to heretics. I know we do get different... We get a lot of people who listen to both podcasts, but we do get different demographic groups. There are some people who only listen to Woven Energy, and there are some people who only listen to Heretics, which is fine. People might like or dislike the subject of the two podcasts, but my point is those two podcasts are massively closely interrelated. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Heretics podcast grew out of this podcast, me and you almost half-jokingly talking about a Miasma podcast. That is pretty much where it came from. And, you know... Esotericism, if you live in a city, if you live in a country with a government, elected or otherwise, then esotericism has a lot to say about your life that shamanism has nothing to say about, nothing whatsoever. So that's a, you know, little plug for the Heretics podcast on Woven Energy.
It's two sides of the same coin, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. But you've got to remember that shamanism evolved for a particular purpose. We talked about it. We've always said shamanism is always directed. It's a very directed thing. And that purpose was to nurture and protect and support hunter-gatherer communities, which are small and don't have huge heavyweight control structures sitting on top of them. The other side of the coin is that we have, for whatever reason, very, very recently, in terms of the age of shamanism, you know, shamanism, as we've said before, it depends how far you go back, but, you know, there are groups of wild animals, social wild animals, that have shamans among them. So we're talking about millions and millions of years in terms of shamanism. In terms of esotericism, how do we use shamanism in settled, civilized society? Well, we had to have settled, civilized societies before we could ever start using shamanism or trying to. You talk about, you know, places like Çatalhöyük or the oldest layers of Jericho, places like that. It's not a long time ago, just maybe over 10,000 years, something like that, compared to millions and millions of years that shamanism has been knocking around. It's just a blink of an eye, really. And so esotericism is new. Get in on the ground on something if you want to get involved in esotericism. Get in on the ground. It's only just started. It's only just begun. Who knows what the future looks like? So,
and your definition of esotericism is basically shamanism in how shamanism manifests itself in civilized settled societies.
Yeah, and we've talked about the ways in which it does that. There are, you know, the major ways in which that occurs are secret societies, and why they're secret is being obvious, because they used to, and in some countries still do, kill you if you were involved in shamanic activity. Or very, at the very least, I mean, in virtually all societies, it gets frowned upon. Anybody who's done any shamanic practice in their lives in a tolerant country, a relatively tolerant country, has probably still had some strange comments from their relatives. You know, I think you're a cult. It sounds like a cult to me, kind of thing. You know, you hear all that kind of thing. Using the word cult in a negative way. I mean, I don't use the word cult in a negative way. There's another trap. You start using the word cult in a positive way. The issue is that, and this, you know, that then one of the fun things to do is then ask them what their definition of a cult is. And then they start saying things like, you know, oh, it's a organization that controls its members and doesn't allow them to think broadly and, you know, is basically controlling and all this kind of stuff, you know. To which I respond, you mean like governments and organized religion? They're all cults. they all control their members. They, some of them even have police, you know. So they're all cults to me. So yeah.
And also, esotericism presents itself in a variety of different ways as well, because you say you've got the smaller kind of elements of it, but you've also got the big religions have esoteric underpinnings, right? There's
yes, that's right. So that was the next
hidden inside big religion.
That's the next thing. I mean, people realize. Well, I mean, secret societies is an obvious thing to do. These guys want to kill us. They don't like what we're doing. Therefore, we go underground, and we don't know. They don't know anything about what we're doing. That's one way to do it. Another way to do it is, like you say, is to take what you see the writing on the wall. For instance, has happened with Mithraism and Christianity. You see the writing on the wall. So you say, okay, rather than create a separate secret society, which is what we've had to date, or a separate group, which is what we'll have to date, let's embed what we love, what we practice within this new thing that otherwise is going to be a threat to us. And that's exactly what happened with Mithraism and Christianity, for instance. And that's how, you know, you end up with Mithraism and Christianity being pretty much the same thing today, which they were certainly not 2,000 years ago. Yeah. So that's another form that it takes. Another form that it takes, obviously, is people who head for the countryside, head out into the woods, go up in the hills, become bandits, all that kind of stuff. I've done that in a lightweight kind of way myself. Well, that's an easy way. Just run away and practice.
You became a bandit.
Well, no, I didn't become a bandit, but I do head off over the moor, especially when the tourists aren't there. Just head off over the moor sometimes. Just get away from people, you know. And then it doesn't matter what you do in terms of shamanism. There's no one but you there and nature there to see it, you know. So it does take a lot of different forms. And then there's the sort of just practicing your shamanism in plain sight. There are things that you can do, and we'll get into them on the mainstream podcast episodes, certainly with your energy changes, that you can do that don't look that odd, that you can do while you're standing at the bus stop or, you know, practice. You can actually practice quite a lot of, especially when you get to more to sort of intermediate to advanced level, once you get into a lot of different changes, there's a lot of practice you can do and nobody will notice that you're actually practicing. There's a lot of things like that that you can do. But in a way, that's kind of figuring out
how
ways to do
practice
that
your shamanism in secret. Or yeah. How to practice your shamanism in front of people and they don't realize it. That's an episode, isn't it? That'd be brilliant.
That's like these guys that they do stealth camping. You know, they don't camp out in the woods. They go and camp in the middle of a major roundabout on a major, you know, junction or something like that on a road or something like that. And they hide their tent in the bushes, this sort of stuff, you know. Very interesting. Very interesting. I think that's like the challenge, you know. And so all of these things, talking about esotericism, all of these things lead to another big pitfall of learning shamanism that we have talked about before, which is obsessing over the roots of the world tree, the Mogni-Ukh in Mongol terms, that huge imbalance that society has created for the baseline, for the roots of the tree.
Episode 4.
Yeah.
Episode 4, I believe, is the episode we went in depth on that.
And I guess that's a danger for the podcast as well. And this is why so many times we've said, please go and practice, please go and practice, please go and practice. Because if you don't, talking to our wonderful listeners and our amazing patrons, thanks guys, if you don't do that, we're sort of wasting our time producing this podcast. Neither myself, nor Joe, nor Graham create this podcast primarily to entertain people. Maybe we did that a little bit with Heretics when we first started off, but we're not even doing it with Heretics anymore. Now we've got the tutorial going. So the purpose of this podcast is not to entertain people. There are loads of more entertaining podcasts out there, probably more entertaining podcasts out there. The purpose is to encourage people to become shamans. That's always what we wanted to do. Or in Heretics terms, I guess, encourage people to become esotericists. Now, this is our new mission with the tutorial is encourage people to become esotericists. The major thing, the major blocker is, oh, this is very interesting. I'm very interested in that. So I'll sit and listen about it and think about it in my brain. Baseline activity, modern uch, roots of the tree. But what about the modern ichbi, the trunk of the tree? What about the modern imotje, the branches and leaves? The universe is a balance between those, if you want to think of mind, spirit, and body, if that's one, or mind, body, and spirit, if you want to think of it in that way. The universe is a balance between those things. But in our societies that we've created over the last 10,000 years, we are absolutely, innately obsessed with just one of those things, which is the mind. And that's East and West. You see it in its most crystallized forms. You see it in the Western tradition in terms of the influence of Aristotle and Plato, Socrates, those guys, and our passion for learning and universities and all that kind of stuff. I understand something in my mind, therefore I understand it. No, you do not. If you understand it in your body and your mind and your spirit, all acting together as one entity, then you really understand it. And it's a big problem in our science, or many branches of our science that especially ones like biology, that could be participative, that could be more esoteric in nature. And there are people like Konrad Lorenz. Let's set all of his major downsides to one side and not mention Nazis and stuff. But Konrad Lorenz involved himself in experiments and found out stuff through doing that, participated in experiments and found out stuff through doing that, that other people wouldn't have found out if they hadn't participated and they'd only observed. So there are people like that within the scientific community who've done some good work along those lines. I think there could be a lot more of that in science than there is currently. Not to say get rid of any of the observer-based stuff, impartial observer. Yeah, what's impartial mean? To me, impartial observer sort of implies that you're very, very, very partial for the baseline. That's what impartial observer says to me. So I think in that term, impartial observer, there's an inherent bias baked into it for the monuch, for the roots of the tree, the world tree I'm talking about, not tree in my garden. Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that attracted me to particularly, the way that you taught shamanism was that it helped me make sense of my own kind of state of mind. Because up to that point, I'm a very baseline heavy kind of person. Naturally, I don't know why. I definitely do think things too much. My brain goes in loops a lot, and I'm generally a very logical and rational kind of guy. And always felt that there was something missing or something wrong with that. And so when all of this stuff started making more sense to me, I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of a way out of that kind of trap. It's a way out of that constant sort of energy sapping, cyclic thought kind of mental state. And yeah. I still suffer from it, but much less than I used to, it must be said.
Yeah. And of course, that leads us on to probably the last one that I'll mention on this one. I'm not precluding doing the pitfalls of learning shamanism part four. I think that the next pitfalls will be all about energy changes. So we'll get some more energy changes down on the main sequence before we do part four of this series. Because the next sort of thing to talk about is once people have got a good practical grasp of a few energy changes. But just the last one here in terms of that obsession with the baseline, we've had the imagination trap. How about the hallucination trap? Hi yom sonsok in Mongol. Hallucinations are what is a social perception. Just the very term hallucination has a massively built-in bias into it. The shamanic technique can lead you as a settled, civilized individual into, as you start applying more advanced shamanic technique, you get what society perceives as hallucinations. It happens. It will happen. And that's the only way I can really describe it, because the words like ki yum sunsok and ki yum karach, there is no English equivalent of those terms, and it would take whole episodes to explain what they're really about. Again, is this to do with a shamanic language like Mongol versus a non-shamanic language, anti-shamanic language like English? Hallucinations is a bad word, really bad word. Just like the word spirit, it has so many permutations that you wouldn't really want to call one thing. But my advice is as we get more into level 5, and this sort of stuff becomes what you might call a danger, a pitfall that's going to be coming up for transitioning into 5. Those things are dangerous because we're obsessed with the baseline in terms of pitfalls of becoming a shaman. If we weren't obsessed with the baseline, they wouldn't be anywhere near so dangerous. But the thing you must never do is interpret them in the, you know, Joseph and his many colored dream coat in Genesis type of interpretation. You know, Pharaoh like Jesus, Pharaoh like Joseph, because he could interpret his bleeding obvious dreams. I mean, for goodness sake, Pharaoh's dreams were so bleeding obvious that I think you could pick a random guy in the street and he would have been able to interpret them, but never mind. It's by the by. The issue is that I saw this, or this happened to me, or I had this experience. So I feel that, being a miasmatically conditioned individual, member of our society that's into this baseline analysis thing, I now have to interpret that in human terms.
It must mean something.
It must mean something. No. I said, no, you are wrong. because it's only these things that, you know, they are side effects of shamanic technique.
So
they
that
are
time,
not what's important. They are not what's important within shamanic technique. They are side effects of the fact that your brain is not good at dealing with non-ordinary states of consciousness. Yeah.
So that time when I was rocking backwards and forwards and entering into a bit of a trance, and then all of a sudden these jewels appeared in the sky and started dancing around.
It's not a bad thing. It's a state. It's a indication that you're getting somewhere. That's not the bad thing. The bad thing is trying to interpret it afterwards. That's the bad thing.
What do those jewels mean?
What do they mean? Exactly. That's the pitfall. As soon as you go down that rabbit hole, you will get no further with your shamanism. You will just put a blocker on any further progress. So try not to. Try not to take it all equally. Don't judge it. Stay in a state of chillicity. Don't judge it. Don't interpret it. Don't place your social values upon it. None of that stuff. Just take it all in, just as you do with normal sensory information when you're practicing your normal states of chillicity. Take it all in. Take it all in equally. It's not good. It's not bad. It's just information. That's all.
Brilliant. One last question, Damon, before we wrap up.
Yep.
Which I suspect will be answered very quickly, although I could be wrong. Okay, I'm no longer Joe. I'm now Jeff. I know nothing about shamanism, but I am interested in shamanism. And I come across this person called Damon. And Damon knows a thing or two about shamanism. And I asked Damon, what is the most important thing that I should keep in mind as a beginner, putting one foot into shamanism, in order to not mess up, to stay on the track, to try and get somewhere with this thing we call shamanic technique?
Yeah, I'm going to quote you, mate. Just stop thinking. What should you keep in mind? What should you keep in mind? Nothing. I mean, joking aside, the first thing you want to, first of all, a beginner in shamanism does not want to be listening to this episode, right? We're here at episode 60. Goodness me. Episode 60 of the Wolf and Angie podcast. If you are a beginner, you want to, all the way back to episode 1, please. It's not that we don't begrudge you the information, but there's a series of building blocks that are needed in order to understand the kind of stuff we're talking about on an episode like this, for instance. And we do have listeners who've been through that process, and we know we've had listeners who've gone out and actually practiced, not just listened and been entertained, but have gone and practiced. Thanks ever so much, guys. That's amazing. Your effort is greatly appreciated, and even got somewhere with it, which is absolutely mind-blowingly fantastic, that we could help people move towards becoming shamans in that way through a podcast is just amazing. But for a beginner, the only thing you need to work on to begin with is being able to get into a state where you're not thinking too much, where you're not interpreting things too much, where you're not placing your judgments on them, where you're not looking at something and say, oh, yes, I understand that, and putting it in a little box and categorizing it. You want to just practice getting into a state where you're not thinking about things very much. That's your first step. That's what we call chillicity. And ideally, and we could say there's a longer road after that. We start having different stages of progression. But that foundation is the foundation of everything. Chillicity is the foundation of everything. Bhaktamstesau, if you don't build a solid foundation for your shamanism, then whatever else you build on top of that will crumble, just like building a big building or pagoda on top of a shaky foundation. The whole thing's going to come down if the foundation isn't strong enough. And you cannot have a better foundation for shamanism than chillicity, because chillicity is what enables you to distinguish what's real from what's your imagination, hallucinations later on, or what, you know. Chillicity is the horn of the chilin that enables you to distinguish between truth and falsehood. But that's not truth and falsehood in religious terms. In fact, I believe this to be true, I believe that to be false. That's a religious true and false. This is a nature-based true and false. Nature demonstrates to me constantly that this thing is true, because if it was false, nature wouldn't be doing this. Do you follow what I mean? To me, in my shamanic technique, we're trying to get ourselves in a state as shamans where nature, not human beings, can teach us stuff. And in order for us to do that, we have to approach nature with an empty cup, not a full cup. And it's very, very difficult. And I'm not saying I'm perfect at it myself, but I'm saying that's the premise behind it. We go to nature with an empty cup. We allow nature to headbutt us through these wonderful shamanic techniques, which are legion. There's thousands, millions of them. We allow nature to headbutt us in the face and give us information, give us stuff to put in our cup. Miki called that the jikimotsu. The natural Jew, the Jew of nature, the jikimotsu, the divine Jew, the learning that can only be derived from nature and not from other human beings. Not to say that nature isn't part of other human beings, there's some learning to be done there. But that is where you want to start if you're starting out on the shamanic path. And your first pitfall would be to try and progress further than that without first emptying your cup. That would be your very first pitfall of all.
Well said. Very good. I think that gently wraps us up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's about an hour, so I think that's cool. That's cool. And like I say, there will be a fall, but I think I'm going to start talking about pitfalls within energy patterns and energy changes, so we need to get a few changes down. I know we've got one out, but we've got to get some more out before we do that one.
Sounds good to me.
Heavy episode next time, Joe, yeah?
Yeah, no worries. Yep. Okay. Cool. Thanks so much for listening, guys. You can head to patreon.com/wovenenergy and support us, help us out there and get some extra stuff back in return. As always, thank you so much for listening, and we will see you in the next one.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky?
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.